Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I actually developed a system for me to determine what I would like to do. I call it the CAPS, Cranston Assessment. Truly, Cranston Assessment Project System.
Bryan Cranston is a great actor, but he also knows how to pick great roles, from playing the dad in Malcolm in the Middle to his Emmy-winning run as Walter White in Breaking Bad to his Tony-winning turn as LBJ on Broadway. Now he takes on the title role in Trumbo, the new film about screenwriter Dalton Trumbo and the Hollywood blacklist. Cranston and Trumbo director Jay Roach tell us what drew them to this story of Hollywood's darkest hour. But first on the news banter, Jon Stewart lands at HBO, and CBS hopes Star Trek will live long and prosper on its streaming service. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my banter buddy, Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Kim.
So Quentin Tarantino, he's been in the news a lot. He attended a rally on October 24th having to do with police brutality, and he said, "When I see murders, I do not stand by. I have to call a murder a murder. I have to call the murderers." And the police unions across the country have not responded well to that and have called for a boycott of his upcoming movie, Hateful Eight.
Yeah, and more recently, he has admitted, I think, to MSNBC that he was surprised by the calls for the boycott, but he's also arguing that I thought I did have First Amendment rights, and so I'm just speaking my mind, and this really has nothing to do with the Hateful Eight, so let's let the chips fall where they may.
And he's also said that he never meant to imply that all cops are murderers. He's saying that when it's some of these situations that we've seen in the news, that he's calling a murder, and he feels that he has the right to do so. I don't know that this really affects the film. I mean, look, Quentin Tarantino is a little vulnerable because of the ultra-violent nature of his films, and I think that he opens himself up to some blowback because of that when he's in this arena. But on the other hand, I don't know that a bunch of cops were going to see Hateful Eight in the first place.
No, and really, I mean, what's also interesting is that Hateful Eight has really nothing to do whatsoever with police brutality. I mean, it's a period piece, takes place during the Civil War, so it's really sort of separate from this issue. And I think most people can separate the artist from the art. So good question of whether or not it'll have real impact on the box office. I don't think so. And it sounds like the Weinstein Company so far is supporting their boy. After all, Quentin is their boy.
He is. But, you know, they're like, yeah, he can say what he wants to say. They're not exactly saying him more than that. It's
well,
just like he's a free person to
all,
say what he
wants to say.
Probably
all they should say at this
yes,
point.
Yes, I think that's probably the politically wise choice. Meanwhile, over in the TV world, we are in a strange time. Not a great launch to the fall season. Blindspot on NBC and Supergirl, I think, are the only things that
right, with Quantico a little behind that. I mean, there have been a couple of decent-sized shows, but nothing that's a mega hit. And so what's interesting, though, is there's also been no big cancellation. Actually, none whatsoever, Kim, which is a little unprecedented, but that's also a reflection of the economics of television and this day and age where, you know, really, you could cancel a show, but you're liable to put on another show that'll do even worse than the one you just canceled.
Yeah, there are websites, actually, that just try to handicap which show is going to be canceled first. And so far, it's been a bit of a wait. We're in November. But, you know, we have a new thing now, which is like trimming is the new cancel, right? We instead of canceling the show, you just cut back on the number of orders, which kind of means not tons of confidence from the network
well,
in
yeah,
the show.
It means you have a lot of shows that are basically dead men walking. They're still on the air, but clearly they're not going to be on the air for much longer. You know, NBC cut The Player from 13 episodes down to 9. ABC cut Blood and Oil, their Sunday show, from 13 episodes down to 10. Fox's Minority Report from 13 down to 10 as well. So we're seeing this across the board. So it's kind of a way to hedge their bets, still amortize their costs on these shows, as it's always a huge expense to cancel them straight out. At least you don't have episodes sitting on shelves. You're actually airing them. You're making a little bit of money in advertising, and then you're wiping your hands clean and moving on.
No, seriously, I do want to extend just a little compassion to these people who have to go and make these shows and feel, I'm sure it must be hard to keep up your energy and want to keep going when it feels, I mean, you're desperately trying to make the thing work.
Yeah, I guess it's better than the alternative, which is showing up to work and realizing that's it, and no one's ever going to see your work. In this case, that you're still continuing even though you know for not much longer, and you can kind of wrap up your story. To tell you the truth, it sort of allows the storytellers at least to give a chunk of an episode, and then you know what they can do. They can then call it a limited run series and compete in the Emmys in that category and say, this was our plan all along.
Whether anybody buys that or not. So perhaps this development, you know, this struggles on the broadcast network front, more than perhaps, are a result of the great explosion in streaming. And we are now seeing people making moves trying to figure out their complicated relationship with Netflix. And I'll start with Time Warner, which owns HBO. They've just announced a 4-year deal with Jon Stewart, late of The Daily Show. He is going to do primarily right now, I'm sure they want him to do more for their channels, but he's going to do digital stuff first. He actually said when this deal was announced, appearing on television 22 minutes a night clearly broke me. I'm pretty sure I can produce a few minutes of content every now and again.
Yeah, HBO is really stocking up their digital property now, HBO Now, which won't just be original HBO series anymore. It'll be some shows that are created especially for HBO Now. So Bill Simmons, formerly of ESPN, has joined the network and will be doing stuff for them. Jon Stewart, like you mentioned, you know, HBO acquired Sesame Street, which, you know, that's a big real streaming play. And then even Vice is doing a newscast, a daily newscast for HBO. Well, HBO execs figure most people are going to watch that online streaming. They're not going to watch it, you know, on the linear network. So this is a new age.
And they see the future and they want to be part of it.
And they, you know, they're competing against Netflix and Amazon. So, you know, you got to do more originals.
Speaking of which, CBS is not really original, but they're going to do Star Trek again. And the idea is that it will be, after it debuts on the broadcast network, you'll have to subscribe to their streaming service, CBS All Access. Not the most expensive yet. This may make it more expensive. They're going to do this thing. And if you want it, you got to subscribe.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of smart when you think about it. It's a property in Star Trek where it does have a loyal fan base that will plop down $6 a month or maybe $10 a month for the commercial free option if they introduce that in order to watch their favorite show. And then they also get a library of content. You know, a lot of CBS properties are on that as well. So it'll be interesting. We'll also see if it actually happens or if CBS gets cold feet and decides, you know what, we've got Star Trek. Maybe we should still put that on the broadcast network and make our money.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Kim.
That's Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. In the 1940s, Dalton Trumbo was one of the highest-paid screenwriters in Hollywood, thanks to movies like Kitty Foyle and 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. He was also a member of the Communist Party. That became a huge liability in the years following World War II, when the House Un-American Activities Committee ruthlessly tried to root out communism where it existed and even where it didn't. As the committee pursued communist influence in Hollywood, Trumbo was called to testify but refused to answer questions. In 1950, he spent 11 months in prison and was subsequently blacklisted, making it dangerous for anyone in Hollywood to associate with him, much less hire him. Trumbo's struggle to earn a living and outlast the blacklist is the subject of Jay Roach's new movie, Trumbo. Bryan Cranston plays the embattled writer, and Louis C.K. plays a composite character who's a fellow communist writer.
I love our country, and it's a good government, but anything could be better.
You talk like a radical, but you live like a rich guy.
It's the perfect combination. The radical may fight the purity of Jesus, but the rich guy wins with the cunning of Satan.
Even while he was blacklisted, Trumbo wrote Academy Award-winning screenplays for Roman Holiday and The Brave One. But he couldn't take his bows because both scripts were written under assumed names. Trumbo was finally able to work in the open in 1960 when he was credited for Spartacus and Exodus. Jay Roach has directed comedies including Austin Powers and Meet the Parents. He's also won Emmys for two HBO movies about recent political history, Recount and Game Change. Those films caught the eye of producer Michael London, who hired Roach for Trumbo. Roach felt one thing was imperative to bring the script to life.
Because of my experience on those films for HBO, I have learned to love research as an idea-generating process. And so, for example, I suggested we get to know the daughters, which had a huge impact on how we looked at the story.
Did you know about Trumbo?
I didn't know that much about him. I loved Spartacus. You know, I saw Spartacus at a drive-in in 1967 when it was reissued in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I'll never forget, us running around going, I am Spartacus whenever we got in trouble. But I was astonished once I read the script and I read Bruce Cook's biography. And then I started reading these letters that he wrote from jail to his family that he wrote to his enemies, that he wrote to his friends. You know, he was an incredible letter writer, and there's this whole giant book of them called Additional Dialogue, and that's what really hooked me on the guy. He's got a big heart and a big ability to express himself.
Before we turn specifically to Trumbo, Brian, I wanted to ask you, I mean, I would have been like a huge fan if you'd stopped with Malcolm. I'm a Malcolm fan, but you've had such an incredible range of roles. And I'm wondering how you figure out what you want to do. You have many agents listed on your IMDb listing at UTA. Or do you talk to them? Do you read the script and ponder? How do you approach that?
I actually developed a system for me to determine what I would like to do. I call it the CAPS, Cranston Assessment. Truly, Cranston Assessment Project System.
I'm sorry.
And
I give
a numerical value to...
I'm trying to decide if you're serious.
No, I'm serious. I'm dead serious. And the first and foremost, the most important element to me, and I've always felt this, is the written word. That doesn't always hold up. I have found out that you can start with a very good story, and perhaps the script itself doesn't fully realize the potential of that story, or vice versa. You could have a great script, but it's kind of clever. Why am I not enjoying this more? What is it really trying to say? Or you can have a great character, but in a story that no one...
There's a lot that can go wrong.
Yeah, there's a lot that can go wrong. So it has to hit a high level on story, script, character, and then we go director and then cast.
Did you literally assign numeric values through the thing?
Yeah.
And you do this all on your own?
Yeah. The variables that are not involved with that is money. I care about money, but it never weighs into whether I accept a project or not. But my agents really care.
Okay.
Really
They guard
care.
The gate.
Exactly. And the second variable is time away from family. So those weigh in heavily as well.
That's interesting. Yeah. And so you've obviously just played LBJ.
Yeah.
And you're going to do it, or have you done it for HBO? I'm not sure. It's filmed?
Jay's did.
Nodding.
Yeah, well, he directed the adaptation.
You directed it. Oh, my gosh. I didn't even realize that. Is that an offshoot of doing Trumbo that you...
I suppose to know each related other. Somewhat, yeah. Mm-hmm. But we hadn't shot Trumbo before Jay was offered the role on LBJ.
The
way.
Bold choice. It could have gone horribly wrong.
Could have gone horribly wrong.
You would have stuck with me for two.
That's right.
Lucky that it did not. So I won't ask you what numeric value you assigned to Jay when you were working through it.
Very
it was
high. Top.
Very high.
Yeah.
Based on Mike Myers movies?
Two things.
I'm teasing Jay.
Previous work, and yes.
Yes.
Not to discount that. Mm-hmm. Those movies worked exceptionally well. And also his dramatic work. But primarily it's when you get together with someone and you get a sense... You see how they work, and he's very unassuming, and he's not an absolutist. You know, he doesn't beat his chest, and he doesn't say "I'm in charge here" kind of thing, which I'm always kind of leery of. And I always look for a relationship that would welcome collaboration. But the truth is that the actor and the writers, we all pitch in, but in order to get it done, it does have to filter through the director. But before that filter, there's a lot of discussion. There's a lot of, it could be heated arguments. Artistic frustration is, I think, a welcome sight, because you know you care when people are frustrated about something. The worst thing that you can have in a relationship like that is apathy.
So is Brian telling me that he became frustrated at times in this process?
Yeah, there were a couple times when you get frustrated, when you can't quite get it, when something's not working, and you get frustrated because there's a clock connected to that, and there's a whole crew standing around, and you're not shooting anything, and you're worried that, it's not coming, it doesn't feel right. And I can't think of anything specific right now.
Not too many places. I remember hitting a couple places where we did have to say, do you think this is working? And we were so often in sync, like, I'm not sure. You could always tell when there were moments we hadn't had a chance to think through quite as much. The party was one. You know, we didn't know how to start the film. I always thought there might be a chance to show the division in the social world, that the town was so polarized, it's hard to imagine the town being divided. The country's pretty divided now, but Hollywood nowadays is pretty homogenous politically. In those days, easily 50-50. I had been to a couple parties where there were a couple people who were super opinionated, and I was like, wow, that's so interesting and refreshing. And so I was really thinking, we should try that. You know, we had, it was an expensive scene and we weren't sure what to do, but it was one of those ones that we didn't get to prep as much, and we were in the middle of the night, you know, thinking, does this seem to be working? I don't know if it's working. Like, we didn't know, but we just kept talking it through, and it's such a healthy dialectical process, a kind of clash of ideas that are both trying to get to a great solution. And out of that, on that day, I think came a better way than we'd imagined to get through it. And that's when you're working with someone who's a great storyteller, not just an actor, someone who Brian's directed, he's written, he's so story-driven. Everything is about story. Even, as you said, kind of almost trumping character, which not every actors tell the story from within the character. Brian's looking at, what's the whole thing going to add up to at this point? Is this really going to be the thing that we want it to be? And I love that. I mean, I probably encourage it to a fault, but we stay on schedule. I still have to decide at the end of the discussion, but to not have the opportunity to kind of kick it around I wouldn't know how to do that.
I want to ask you one more question, Brian, about the way you deal with your career, which is, you know, it seems to me that when you play a character that becomes very iconic in pop culture, it can be very difficult to move away from that character. And you've done it now more than once. You know, you went from being Malcolm's dad to being Walter the myth cooker. Do you think in terms of, like, am I going to be this guy, or how do I ever get away from being this guy? Or do you just think, I want to do this and I'm doing it?
Well, I think you do need to take into consideration where you want to place yourself. So when Malcolm in the Middle finished 7 years, I made a specific decision not to do a comedy. And I got two offers to do two pilots of Sweet Goofy Dads. And it was an easy no from my point of view. Others would say, but you're perfect for this. This is perfect for you. And I'm saying, I just did that. Why would I want to be derivative of myself? And again, I wasn't money motivated. And, you know, if you work 7 years on a television series, you better take care of yourself financially. You better squirrel it away so that you have the power to say, no, that's not the best thing for my career to do that. So I pulled back and I directed a couple pieces. I directed a comedy and things like that, and doing some interesting things. And then Breaking Bad comes along. And I thought, oh my, this is amazing. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, if this manages to survive, I think whoever gets this job of Walter White, it's going to change his life. And it did. And it changed my life. And it created opportunities. So what happens? I do Walter White, and it becomes this iconic character. It avalanched out of my control, and I realized, okay, I need to step away. I can't do television right now. I think that's a bad move, but I want to keep working. I love to work, so where do I go? Theater. And I couldn't wait to do theater. So the message was out, let's find a good play. And my agents came back and said, we found it. And I said, really? He said, it's about Lyndon Johnson's first year in office. And I went, oh my God. And I read it, and it also checked off all those marks. And I thought, oh my goodness, Here we go.
Coming up after a short break, Jay Roach and Brian Cranston tell us about changes that Trumbo's daughters wanted in the film about their father, and how the movie handles the contentious issue of who gets credit for breaking the blacklist. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW radio.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Brian Cranston and director Jay Roach about the new movie, Trumbo, about blacklisted Hollywood screenwriter Dalton Trumbo. The villain of Trumbo is gossip columnist Hedda Hopper, played by Helen Mirren, who became obsessed with sniffing out any whiff of communism in Hollywood.
Oh, come on, I hear the rumors. Show me you're still in the game, fighting in the good fight. Come on, rub my face in it. Whisper a movie you've written in secret. Maybe I've even heard of it.
Maybe you have.
By 1960, Hedda Hopper lost the battle when Kirk Douglas and director Otto Preminger separately agreed to put Trumbo's name on their latest projects, Spartacus and Exodus. Trumbo died in 1976, but his daughters, Nikki and Mitzi, both recall living through their father's travails, and both served as consultants on Roach's film. He says their input was essential, but also complicated because the daughters didn't always see the story the same way.
They were quite a few years apart, Nikki and Mitzi. Nikki was a teenager when this was going on, and she had a lot more direct experience with her father right in this tough time. Mitzi was much younger. She was, as we portray, I think she was two or three years old when we first start. So she has a whole different kind of experience, and so they each came at it very, very differently. It was about, I would say, a year before we shot that we started talking to them. They gave us a ton of notes, especially Mitzi had a lot of notes. And some of them we didn't do them. You know, some of them we just thought, well, we've heard other versions of the story. And she had a strong opinion about that, that we weren't just going to do all her notes. And yet the ones that she engaged with us on, like the whole second act thing of Trumbo actually taking on the blacklist and using his writing superpowers to undo it, that was really Mitzi focusing us in on that. And it was so helpful. Again, it was a fun, it was Trumbo-esque. I really think
yeah,
we were all
true.
Very...
That's a good point.
Trumbo was very much about this kind of debate. He was a debater in high school, and he's an orator, and he loves the clash of ideas, so it was very Trumbo-esque.
He was the type of man that when something he sees is... not operating properly, whether the rates on your electric bill are too high or the abundance of homework for the kids. And people would normally say, you know, someone ought to do something about that. Well, he's the guy who does something about that. He was a prolific letter writer, and he would sit down and he would pound out a very colorful, interesting but pointed letter about the utility rates and ridiculous amount of money that you expect normal people to be able to pay, you know, and the same thing he would write about everything. He was so prolific. It was in his blood. It was in his fingers. He had to write, which points to the fact that when the blacklist was created and tried to oppress that part of his life, it was taking away the man's dignity. And that's what we tried to portray as the importance of that.
I did not know about the thing between Kirk Douglas and Otto Preminger as to who broke the blacklist. And I know, having now done some actual reading, that the family felt so strongly that Kirk Douglas has dined out for a long time. I am the one who broke this. I mean, you know, to his credit, he takes pride in breaking the blacklist and getting Dalton Trumbo's name on a screenplay. But the widow of Dalton
Cleo,
Trumbo boycotted a Writers Guild event because they would not honor Otto Preminger at the same time as they honored Kirk Douglas. That is a very strong feeling on the part of the family. And, you know, I know you ultimately did show the film to Kirk Douglas, I read.
Yeah.
And he said he was fine with it. But that is a very sensitive topic among many in this movie. Many.
Yeah. I think it's a matter of point of view. I think the way Kirk Douglas experienced the whole breaking of the blacklist was different from the way that the Trumbo family experienced it. And it really was a kind of, you know, the piece of the elephant that each saw. What Kirk Douglas did was unbelievable. He risked so much. He had put his own money into making Spartacus. He'd fired the director, hired Stanley Kubrick, had his whole production company tangled up in the finances of it. And comes along and says, I know what we'll do to make it more commercial. We'll put a communist screenwriter, you know, on the credits who's never been credited and who's blacklisted. So the essential part of that story is that Kirk Douglas did an incredible thing. And the night that we portray in the film, when Dalton Trumbo's name comes up on Spartacus at the premiere, that is the night it began to evaporate. It is also true that Otto Preminger came out several months before and announced he was going to put Trumbo's name on Exodus. So he kind of got the jump in public on Spartacus. And the only disagreement was about when did Kirk Douglas intend to put Trumbo's name. And that is a subject to a lot of different stories. But the essential truth, neither of those guys broke the blacklist. The writers had at least as much to do with it. This is why I always say Dalton Trumbo and the writers, the many writers who kept writing during the black market. And Trumbo wins 2 Academy Awards, writes Spartacus, and many other writers are writing so many good movies that the studios had to say, what are we doing? This is insane.
Well, you didn't ask Kirk Douglas beforehand. I mean, you just presented him with a fait accompli of
the movie. We talked to him beforehand. We went and talked to him and we told him exactly what we were doing. And he had opinions about it. And he was very sweet and funny about it too. He said, it may be just that I have too big of an ego to share credit with Dalton Trumbo. He was very self-aware about it.
The other point was that I did talk to Kirk after he saw the movie. And he not only thought it was fine, he thought it was a very good film. And he had one complaint. He thought that the producers should have considered hiring him to play himself in the movie.
Okay. I figured you were going to say something.
But he deserved the lionization of that the film goes in. He was very happy when he saw the film.
Well, so now you're dealing in a world where I think the only thing that I've read was the memorable Ann Coulter headline, from meth cook to Hitler apologist. That's you, Brian, obviously. Yeah.
Meth cook to Hitler apologist.
But, you know, you're treading on, I know there was sensitivity in the family, too, about how John Wayne is portrayed, and certainly he is, you know, the Green Beret guy and an icon to the right. Do you feel blowback developing, or do you think that will not happen?
There was a time in the early development of the script where John Wayne had a much bigger role, and there was a vestigial scene where they had kind of reconciled at the end. But the film was so dense and complex and long that since John Wayne's character had kind of, Hedda Hopper was brought in after we started developing it together, and once Hedda Hopper became the more vocal and sort of determined nemesis of Trumbo's, the John Wayne seemed somewhat tacked on, if you will.
Yeah.
So we did end up cutting that, but it was actually a scene that sort of softened John Wayne. But what I saw was that John Wayne, in truth, was very different from Hedda Hopper. He actually did believe that a person could cooperate to some extent. He was never apologetic about being strongly into the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of the American Ideals, which did invite HUAC. He actually plays a HUAC investigator in a movie he drove called Big Jim McLean. He'd never had any qualms about being a part of this particular campaign to help clean up Hollywood from these, you know, I think he would say less than loyal, you know, writers. But he did help people get their careers back together, as we portray with Edward G. Robinson, if they would go a certain distance and talk it through with him.
He went a long distance.
That distinguished him from Hedda and people like Hedda, and there were a lot of people like her who, once a commie, always a commie. These are traitors. Get them out of here. And so I just suggested that we dig deeper into the research and figure out what really went down with John Wayne. And we always use the notes to go deeper, make it better, get the story right. That's the motto, is just get it right. And I feel like we ultimately did get that aspect of it right.
Jay Roach is the director of Trumbo, and Brian Cranston is the star. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna and Grant Buckerfield. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.